Okay, it's adopted. Now, the next issue, sub-issue that we had was the issue of when evidence should be admissible. I guess notwithstanding what we have done already, is that still a viable separate issue, or has that been subsumed now by what we've done?
No.
I suppose, Jeff?
I think theoretically it could still be the test applied at the sentencing stage. Disregarding the other problems.
Yeah, that was what. Linda?
Yeah, that's
okay, let me ask if the subcommittee has any comment on its assessment of the need to make any change in that regard in the present law.
This is the issue now. Let me get, you don't actually get, this is the bifurcated trial situation, right? Well, you know, to me, this is very much tied up with the plea issue as well as how you're going to find the plea. You know, maybe it's cosmetic, but you know. And this goes very much to the public perception issue. Obviously, in a mens rea situation, as Attorney Mike Swain's in the audience, obviously in a mental state situation, you're going to be able to bring in psychiatric evidence. But in terms of saying that you're guilty or not guilty, and then allowing, in terms of the issue of insanity, mental disease, a defect, to first be raised, the task force, the interim committee, as I recall, Representative Springer, of course, excluded this statement, felt strongly, as I recall, that it wouldn't to allow it at the sentencing stage would be a more appropriate and a better way to handle the whole situation. I don't know. I'm trying to read the political signals here on this one, because this is significant. This is significant. Not the first time it's always been significant. But this is a big change. As I recall, Felicia, you took no position on this. The board took no position on this. Jeff took one for sure. He's opposed to it.
No, I guess we really didn't, because we felt our function was more.
Right. You're not involved in this. Jeff just felt it was bad public policy, as I recall. Right?
Yes, and some other reasons as well.
Yeah, would you help me with that?
Would you care to review your position together right here on this issue?
I think it raises potential constitutional objections. In fact, the district attorneys brought those up in their comments on 2075. The Wedge case, which as I read it, holds to the effect that as to aspects of the crime, the Oregon Constitution requires a jury determination, as opposed to characteristics of the defendant, which can be determined by the judge at sentencing. And I think when you're talking about mental disease or defect at the time of the crime, as in the definition which you have decided to retain, that is an aspect of the crime. I think by taking the decision away from the jury, you would surely invite constitutional challenges which might be successful, and you might end up having broken something which doesn't need fixing. So there is some that constitutional possible problem. Secondly, I think as a policy matter, it is important to allow the interjection of the community's sense of morality, if you will, into these kinds of determinations as an underpinning. As we know, about 3% of the cases that are successful go to juries, but to have that as a backdrop for the decisions made by DAs and defense attorneys, I think, is appropriate. Secondly, it does allow, in extreme cases such as the Lawrence Moore case, prosecutors to utilize the jury when they believe that the person should be convicted in spite of all the experts and all the judges saying to the contrary. The Lawrence Moore case can be argued either way, but it certainly is an example of a situation where prosecutors got what they want and could only have gotten what they want with the aid of the jury, I suggest. Third, I think that by putting the decision under the judges, you risk having a great increase in commitments to the review board of, quote, inappropriate people. It is going to be a decision made solely by the judges. I think it is very fair to say that judges are quite favorably disposed towards the review board. We've had situations where judges insisted that people be placed under the review board that everyone felt the judge did not have jurisdiction to do. I think if it's seen as a sentencing alternative, you risk, as I say, an increased number of inappropriate placements, including just an ignoring of the personality disorder exclusion. All kinds of people going to the review board to get treatment because they get it better there and get longer supervision because they do get longer supervision than the parole board. So for those reasons, I think it could well backfire.
Good to see us.
Representative Corden.
Now it's coming back to me. This was the very area that I felt we could purify the insanity plea. You've just blown that right out of the water, which fascinates me, because the Moore case to me is a brilliant example of an individual who was, I say, you know, smoking the drapes day and night. And everybody knew it. Everybody knew it who participated in the trial. And they said no. And the reason they said no is because the crime was so heinous. And ironically, this proposal, in my opinion, of course, you're the one who knows better than I do, I feel would put more people on the Psychiatric Security Review Board, but that's not bad. To borrow your own words, a few weeks ago, a utopian system would have everybody on the Psychiatric Security Review Board. I'm somewhat surprised you think that judges would be throwing more people in there as opposed to juries, but, you know, I think unless we drastically do something in Category 3 here in terms of this change of guilty, I don't know if I want to sit in a jury, and if you bring in a horrible enough crime, am I going to say someone's not guilty or innocent or not responsible? And when you have that situation in front of a jury with a bad enough crime, Jeff, then in my opinion, the jurors are an impossible situation. Whereas if you remove them from having to make that kind of decision, and maybe you do that by a cosmetic change in terms of the plea, Mr. Shearer, that's the reason I was talking about that, being connected to this. But otherwise, you do not really have an insanity plea available opportunity. It's a myth. It's a myth. It's really a myth.
Sir? There are two ways of interpreting the Moore case, I suggest. One is what you say, the crime was just so terrible. The other, but there's a comment to be made about that. Maybe the community has a right to say that crime is too terrible, we're not going to have an insanity defense. But secondly, the second interpretation is the one that Dale Penn gave, which is that even real crazy people may be responsible for their conduct because they don't meet the other prongs of the test. And that was what he hammered on with a jury, he tells me. And the jurors said afterwards they agreed he was crazy, but they didn't think that he lacked the capacities that would have made him insane. Now, maybe that's a smokescreen for their thinking about the heinousness of the crime, but I'm not sure that to try to analyze that case and to take care of one case, a major change like that should be made. If you are really trying to increase the number of people in the review board, why not do it both? Let it be raised at the jury, and then let the judge also put people under the review board as a sentencing decision, even if the jury doesn't find an insanity defense. I've felt throughout these proceedings that some of the suggestions being made are inconsistent. Some are to decrease the numbers under the board, some are to increase the numbers, and what I read is really is just a lot of pressure about the insanity defense per se from around the country. And that really we're pretty close to the right amount of people getting under the review board now as it is. You don't want to increase it too much, you don't want to decrease it too much. But if your concern really is that the jury rejects it too often, then let the judge say Lawrence Moore was found guilty, but as a sentencing matter, I think he should go to the review board. I don't recommend that. I think that would be a mistake.
Oh, I think so too. Oh, Lord, yes. Unless we made a change here like this, I would think that'd be all not so. You say it's about one case, but obviously it's these one cases. So celebrated cases that very much affect a lot of things we do. It was my understanding from these jurors that they, in terms of a particular program I think we were both on, that they were saying they did think he was crazy. And I don't know if they were making these distinctions, but still responsible. I had the feeling they were saying, I'm not about to say that guy wasn't guilty. They were very upset, but enough said, Mr. Chair, because I'm just curious to know what the other members of the committee think at this stage of the game. Sensing.
Mr. Spear, you were. You were locally, you were current.
Well, I guess I'm satisfied by the reasoning advanced by Mr. Rogers that however we turn to, how we choose to term this kind of proceeding, what issues are going to be resolved by the jury, quote unquote, which are the sentencing issues for the judge. I just feel that the system as it is now works reasonably well, notwithstanding some individual problems from individual cases. I don't think, for a lot of the reasons have already been described, that it's that we ought to change the present structure or the nature of the proceedings, the sequence in which issues remain within the purview of the jury or issues are those for the court. I don't think we ought to change.
Is it Hill, Moore, are you comfortable with that?
I'm comfortable with it.
Mr. Chairman, I just have real problems with taking the people out of the process. I think that the only way we'll have any type of integrity here is that...
what do you mean, take them out of the process?
I don't think that we should. I think the jury should have a say on this.
Oh, I see.
I think they do reflect the community. I think it's leaving it up to a judge. I think that judges are elected. And I think that people will be more trusting of the decisions made by the jury. I guess we'll leave it the way it is.
President Miller? Mm-hmm.
I tend to concur with what Representative Hill was laid out.
This is a problem,
Chair, I move that the House Bill 275 be amended to delete any modifications to the procedure by which the defense of mental disease or defect is asserted, its timing, and the method of its resolution. As a defense. Further discussion? Representative Lombard, before I put that question, let me update you.
Would like to know what I voted for.
We have done a couple things so far. First of all, we have...
we haven't tabled the bill.
No. We have agreed to exclude disorders characterized only as personality disorders from the definition of mental disease or defect.
Okay.
We have moved to delete any changes in the definition or the statement of the legal test for insanity. And we are on the verge, subject to whatever thoughts you might have that might change that, we're on the verge now of deleting any changes in the method by which the entire procedural mechanism by which the defense itself is asserted, the relative role of a jury versus the court in determining the resolution of the defense, in a sense, restoring the state or maintaining the status quo in that regard.
Okay, so in other words, it remains an affirmative defense and goes not only to the mens rea, but stays up front.
Did you wish to comment on that?
I didn't realize that I could have that much influence on the final decision.
I don't know if you'll have any. You may wish to have your own thoughts recorded, or you might be able to turn this thing completely around.
I don't know which direction it's going. I'm not sure which direction I want to turn it. See? No, I tried to read these bills again coming over the Sandy Am, and Representative Bellamy was driving at a very low altitude, flying at a very low altitude.
All that happens is that you got quite nauseated.
My eyeballs are going around the corners about half a mile behind the car. Now, you may proceed.
Further discussion of the chair's motion? Anyone clear on the motion? Is there objection to the motion?
I object.
Do?
Yes, I do.
Adopted.
That was my real, one of my big babies.
We heard something about it. You had a baby during the interim.
The third, and of course, I guess related issue is the issue of a change to the name or characterization of the plea, of the verdict, plea of the verdict. Linda, would you like to review that for us?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, in existing law, 161.319 states when the defendant is found not responsible. Due to mental disease or defect, as defined in ORS 161.295, the verdict and judgment shall so state. Another place that's now occurring to me where it's, does it say somewhere else in the statute not guilty due to mental disease or defect in existing statute?
In 161.295, it uses the term not responsible.
They use not responsible, but
319. Did you know 319?
Yeah, that's the one I was referring to that says the verdict and judgment shall so state. There's another place that's in existing law 161.309 that says a defendant who's required to give the notice of their intent to assert that defense shall file written notice of his purpose at the time he pleads not guilty, which I've always found a little bit confusing because all the rest of it, as I can recall, refers to it as not responsible. And 161.319 is repealed in House Bill 2075. I think we have to separate this decision a little bit because of the other changes we've made so far. I guess I would just refer to the types of pleas or verdicts that have been suggested along the way and that are listed here. Some have mentioned not responsible, guilty but not responsible, not guilty due only to mental disease or defect. That's the one that's used in the Attorney General's bill. Not guilty, it was under 2075. If you negated culpable mental state, then you just had a not guilty verdict. Another one that Jeff Rogers had mentioned, and he supplemented my issue outline here with reminding me that his suggestion had been to say guilty except for legal insanity.
What was that again?
guilty except for?
Legal insanity, yes.
Okay. Yes, ma'am. Okay.
Representative Court.
I think this is cosmetic. I'm not going to play games about it, but this is critical. I even think PSRB said that it would help them in terms of treating some of these people. We've got to have the word guilty in there. I like to track it as close to the law now as possible. The only thing I come up with is guilty, but with a mental disease or defect, or guilty with a mental disease or defect. Now, I don't know why that wouldn't be able to get the job done, because mental disease or defect we already use guilty, and that way it qualifies it to get the person out to or under the jurisdiction of PSRB, you know, assuming you put it where you put it. But I think the word guilty does have to be in there, obviously followed by qualifiers to let the world know it's going on to PSRB. That's where I'm coming from. And I think the interview group felt pretty strongly about this. We were backed up. Police is here, and they put it in writing. They do support that change.
Some of the implications, I guess I'd like other input maybe from Mr. Rogers or PSRB or whoever else about some of the effects of how you word it, because if, for instance, if you say guilty without some sort of a but for or except that, first of all, I presume that would be considered a conviction. Unless, I think maybe that's what
Association. What I brought to the table with me was the American Psychiatric Association statement on the insanity defense dated December 1982. I would simply bring to the committee's attention that the American Psychiatric Association has taken a position on whether or not to proceed by way of a guilty but not responsible sort of plea, and they come out firmly against it. This is contrary to the position apparently taken by members of staff on the PSRB. To the extent that the therapeutic rationale is given, the American Psychiatric Association just has not bought it. If you don't have a copy of that, that might be useful if you get concerned about it. I know I'm speaking after a motion was made, and I'm not too sure what consequence that has. Secondly, I'd simply like to refresh our recollections that this kind of a plea carves out an exception that exists nowhere else in the entire criminal justice system, a guilty but not responsible, or a guilty but not guilty is found nowhere else. As in your self-defense situation, the homicide, we don't say that he's guilty of murder, but he's not responsible for it. We say that he has, in fact, a defense. Throughout the whole course of Anglo-Judaic jurisprudence, there is only guilt when there is an act in the absence of a defense. You have now changed that by this motion if it should pass and be legislated into law, where you can have the act with a defense rendering guilt. This has happened nowhere else in terms of a change in that kind of theoretical underpinning of the system. I feel finally that the plea of not responsible, as you see in our existing statute, there's no reference to not guilty. It's not responsible. That's not a happen chance situation. It's because the plea of not responsible was determined by the people at the American Law Institute after having examined it for nearly a decade to be a plea which implies the fact that the person committed the act was guilt, was therefore the person who had committed the act is Reyes, but because of the existence of a defense, the person was not responsible. To say one's guilty but not responsible is a contradiction in terms and is a serious step, and there's ramifications that follow from that. Excuse me, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I think that you are slightly misdescribing exactly what we have done. I'm not saying what we've done is necessarily the right policy. I for one, want to continue to think about that before the bill is finally approved. But we have not said guilty, but not. We said guilty except for insanity. Now, there is a distinction, I think. It is not, you are not saying guilty.
I have difficulty with that, and I sense that others will as well. To say we're saying guilty, but we're not saying guilty. I think that that there's consequences that flow from using the term guilty, even in the report.
I think it would be different. I think it is different to say guilty except for something. That is different from saying guilty but not responsible. I think the first version, you are not saying guilty.
I think one could...
saying but for such and such, it would be guilty.
I think that one could infer from that you're saying except for the fact the person has a legal offense, he would otherwise be guilty. I simply say that if that's the case, not responsible is an appropriate term. And there is no need to confuse the waters by having two contradictory statements appear in juxtaposition to themselves. That's the only comment I wish to make. I appreciate the courtesy.
Yeah, Representative...
Well, Mr. Chairman, this may be new, it may be contrary to what has historically been the case, but a number of other states are doing the same thing. As of July 1982, over half a dozen states had adopted the guilty but mentally insane verdict. So I'm not plowing any newer water than what some other states are doing. I suspect that they're responding in the same way we are, in great part, to a public perception of what's going on.
And I think that you'll find that each of those are relatively recent. As a response to the Hinckley trial.
Exactly. Exactly. I think we have to call it up front and say that's exactly what's happening. We are too. I don't feel hidebound to the traditional terminology.
I'd still say, without at this point disputing the merits again, only that the action of this subcommittee at this point is, however, different even from those versions of the plea.
Correct.
To say guilty but mentally ill, I interpret in a different way than saying guilty except for mental illness. Now, perhaps from various perspectives there is no difference, but I think as a policymaker we're making a different statement.
I guess I try.
I'm not saying it's necessarily right yet. I think it bears some further pondering before the committee takes any final action on it.
As a defense attorney, I guess I'm viewing that in the context of a defense instruction. What am I going to say as the court allows Mr. Swain to stand up and address the jury? How am I going to explain that to the jurors? They are not going to probably make these kind of fine distinctions, and they're going to be captured by the immediate impression of the words that you use at the beginning. Guilty is going to set a trend in their thought. Except for is going to be where the battle is going to be waged. When you get right down to it, I think we conclude that we're saying that as a result of the causal factor of the mental disease or defect, the person is not responsible. And I understand the political aspect of it. I understand the misunderstanding in the public, but I would simply submit that education is the anecdote, not a change in the wording of the statute.
Questions?
This is not exactly related, but since Mr. Swain's up here, can I just ask about that notice in the saying that they notice that they're pleading not guilty? Do you know what part I'm talking about?
Yes.
Is that what they do? You plead not guilty? And when you give notice that you're going to use an insanity defense?
That's
as opposed to saying not responsible or something at this time?
You know, quite frankly, I think that we do say not guilty by reason of mental disease defect. I think that's sloppiness in our profession.
Okay, thank you.
There's no statutory authority for that plea, however.
Yes, well, it is in the notice. Section 10.
But the defense is in terms of non-responsibility. The consequence is the person is found not guilty, in effect because of his lack of responsibility. There's an absence of the juncture between the actus reus and the mens rea or the volitional element that you've been talking about.
Can I ask one more?
Mm-hmm.
In the existing statute where it says that the verdict's going to say when the defendant's found not responsible due to malaise or defect, the verdict and judgment shall so state.
Mm-hmm.
What is the practice of the courts as a, I don't know how wide broad practice has been, but what do they say? Do they say the person is not responsible?
At least in Marion County, they attempt to follow the statute and use the statutory language.
And do they give grounds, or do they just do a general reference, or do they say like conformed conduct, or because they couldn't appreciate criminality?
Different judges do it differently. Some are more specific. No one gets down to naming particular psychiatric disorders, but some will determine or make their basis one of volition, some of cognition. Some will just put both of them together in the language of statute. The lack of substantial capacity to conform or to understand the nature and consequences.
But they don't say not guilty in their verdicts, or do they? Do they not?
I can only say what I'm personally aware of, and the ones I've seen. I do a lot of post-conviction work. They usually, when they get down to putting it into writing, they usually use the language of the statute.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Felicia, would you like to come back up? Jeff? The next group of issues we've identified are dispositional issues, the first of which is whether to distinguish disposition based upon crime committed, including possible transfer into corrections division after discharge, restrictions on the board's ability to conditional release, and period of jurisdiction. Linda, do you wish to make any introductory comments there?
I guess there's a question of whether, trying to figure what the other things that we've changed. There could still be differences. I didn't know Representative Courtney had offered amendments very early on, which never were adopted, but did take away that. It left specially designated offenses,
yeah,
but did not have the transfer to the corrections division. I suppose under the existing law, under the motions made so far by the committee, you still could make distinctions in the treatment somehow.
Mr. Courtney?
Yeah, I ought to update this. Just start from where we are now as opposed to where we were. It would be my recommendation, insofar 2075 is just opposed to this, it should be amended to say, for purposes of discussion here today, Mr. Chair, that in terms of those crimes that we, as members of this, the 81 session, updated, the aggravated murder crimes, I believe that's correct, Representative Lombard, Representative Spring, remember we worked on that list, we updated that list, that group of lists, only in terms of those crimes. And remember that group of the ones?
Aggravated murder.
Yeah, only in terms of those crimes, if an individual is found to be insane, now using the, I'm not trying to confuse you, but the way we're insane, and they're, therefore, based on the jurisdiction of PSRB, the PSRB be allowed to maintain jurisdiction over them for the length of the sentence. It's handed down. Now, they still have, and once having said that, all other authorities that PSRB now has should remain intact, which is divergent from what we have in 2075 now, because originally we said they could not conditionally release those individuals, and I'm backing off that now. So in other words, they should be allowed to deal with those people as they see fit as the board. However, the difference being that now, as I understand the law, that once they decide in their wisdom that the sanity has been treated and no longer exists, they must discharge them. Their jurisdiction is terminated. I'd say here, under the approach to 2075, that that would no longer be the case, that even if the insanity had been treated, that they would maintain this jurisdiction, albeit on a conditional release basis, obviously, for the duration of the sentence. And these amendments, in effect, although I would better be careful, were in effect attempt to do that. But I do not know if these amendments are complete in terms of the list of crimes or not. So I don't know how accurately we should track, nor should we assume from this list of amendments that Psychiatric Security Review Board is necessarily on board, because as Felicia and I were discussing moments ago, we need to discuss this issue with footnote.
Felicia?
Okay, if I might first point out, the amendments, which are dated 2/21/83, only start doing what Representative Courtney said, and that's putting back the functioning of the board as it is. And I have some further amendments that's in my testimony of to put it back the way it is. If you amend the bill to basically get rid of the language in 2075 and go back to the language we now have and make amendments to that, that'll take care of it. But there's also some other concern, and I might first point out that the board initially took the position that we would not be opposed to maintaining jurisdiction over people that were found now not responsible, or whatever the term is, for the maximum period of time as an alternative to the proposal that people once discharged would go into the corrections division. And we haven't really taken a position since, or the board hasn't really talked about it since that time, because this is, you just now took the official action to get rid of the corrections, or are going to be taking the position to not get the corrections division involved. My concerns with the board maintaining jurisdiction for the maximum period of time are this. The law now reads that the board shall discharge the person if they prove by preponderance that the person no longer is affected by a mental disease or defect, or if so affected, no longer presents a substantial danger to others. The reason we'd rather maintain jurisdiction longer would be that you can have testimony before at a board hearing of an outpatient, say somebody that's been, that we have jurisdiction for 20 years and is in the hospital for a couple of years, and then is out on conditional release and does pretty well, and then comes in with their supervisor and social worker and doctor coming to testify, or even the supervisor or social worker recommending that they be discharged because they either no longer have a mental illness, or if it's in remission that they're no longer dangerous. And there have been cases where I've gotten calls of somebody that was discharged from the board's jurisdiction and now is starting to have problems again, and we tend to hear from that because either the district attorney or the victim or somebody calls us to ask us to do something, and once, of course, we discharge them, we can do nothing. So I personally would have no problem with maintaining, and I think the board would have no problem with maintaining jurisdiction longer in some cases. The problem you'll get into, and I don't know how to deal with it, is what do you do with the cases of somebody that maybe was in the hospital for a couple of years, originally had a 20-year term, was on conditional release for 6 years or 5 years and did very well, wants to be discharged? Our conditional release at that point, if they're doing very well, could be starting to be fairly minimal. Maybe they can self-report. We have one patient that's just self-reporting. So you could get less and less restrictive as we go on. But what do you do? I'm not sure about the constitutional effect if 10 years later they're still under our jurisdiction, well beyond any time they would have served in the correction system, and the testimony is complete. You know, everybody coming to testify says they either no longer have a mental illness, or if it is, it's in remission, it's so well controlled, there are absolutely no danger to other people. I just don't know how to deal with that. That's the major problem of maintaining jurisdiction for the full length of time. So we're talking about 20 years or life or five or whatever the term is. If you take the next step, the next most lenient step would be that we would retain jurisdiction up to the amount of time that the corrections division would, but then you have to get into some kind of a matrix, and we don't want to do that. And I'm not sure whether you either have the full term or you have what we now have now, and I don't know if there's any medium point or not. But I don't have a solution. We also, I think, don't really have research on the issue in terms of problems that have occurred. I know that Jeffrey Rogers, that's one of the areas he wants to be dealing with, but we don't really have the research. We've got very good research of who we have under our jurisdiction, but once they're discharged, we don't have a follow-up to do that. So I can't even give you information on that, except to tell you that I have gotten some calls of people that have been discharged and are starting to have some mental problems again, and people are worried enough to call us and ask us to do something, and we have to say they're discharged and we can't do anything. They just have to be charged with a new crime.
What does the court mean?
Well, it's out there for everyone to chew on. The interesting thing I note here is that, and I don't know how well this bill is going to fare in this committee and watch some groans start now. I thought about another bill, Representative Springer. I know you were going to oppose this. Troop came with a bill that sex offenders register. And first it startles you, and then I found out it's being done like in California, in the San Francisco area, and there's no limit on how long they have to register. Apparently they have to register, and that's it. There was amendments offered on that bill. I'm going to tie it in, Mr. Chair, that we only allow, make requirement this to register for 5 years. What I'm saying here is that we're only talking about a certain group of crimes, very serious crimes, very, very serious crimes. We backed off on them saying they can't discharge, they can't conditionally release. I say, conditionally release, even during the period of time that you're still trying to find out whether they have the disease or defect. I don't know how you get there. Whether you put, without getting to a matrix system, I don't know, you've heard testimony here that they do get these calls, and given the nature of the crime they, given the nature of their actions in the past, I won't get in this guilt, not guilty thing again, they've been involved in a certain type of very impacting type of activity in the past. And, I think we owe it to society to make sure that we are overly careful and overly cautious and make sure that there's not a chance they're going to do it again. And that's all we're trying to do here. We were trying to do in 2075 in terms of their expertise and their treatment facilities. So I don't think it's a bad idea. I think it's constructive. We're going to probably, and here's the thing, I wish they knew this. I'd like to know what percentage of people we're talking about. I'll bet it's very, very small. Very small number of people. And I'm not so sure public policy doesn't demand that in terms of the small number of people that we don't go this, take this major step.
Jeff?
Just a question there, Representative Courtney. A small number of people, we may know how many people it would be, if that's what you mean, in terms of how many people would be affected. If we're given a list of the
you should
the crimes,
be able to if we identify the crime.
We've identified the number of specially designated offenders using the list as it was originally in 2075.
Let me hold it. But the thing is, I'm not sure, and I've always wondered about this, Linda, help me, that the specially designated crimes 2075 are the true list. I think that's a much larger list, or is it, Linda? Did we track what we did in the aggravated murder, or is it a larger list? Because some of the crimes on here, I felt were not the kind, I didn't think they should be there, to be very frank. In other words, I'm saying I don't think they're that serious. I'm going to be very frank with you. We made a policy decision in 81, and Representative Rombard said you made it in 75 and 77, that these are really pretty bad crimes, this aggravated murder group. And it was only in that group of crimes that we were trying to address in 2075, and I think we went beyond that list.
Well, maybe I'm misunderstanding it, but this list includes assault in the first degree, assault in the second degree, robbery in the first degree.
And also intent to commit.
an attempt to commit any such crime.
Right.
So it's very broad.
So that's what I meant. I don't, this is too broad, Mr. Chair, and that's why his statistics as to what they would have now are not accurate in the sense, unless he could just immediately come up with them. This is too broad.
Well, let's start.
Seven of the murder.
Yeah, here you have seven.
Okay, let's start by trying to get clarified what offenses we would consider as appropriate for some extended period of board jurisdiction, which I guess is the ultimate issue that we got to here. What offenses, Representative Courtney, are you talking about now in reference to this list you're referring to? Are you talking about those offenses which would constitute aggravated murder?
Correct.
No. I don't know why I'm having trouble.
Yes, the aggravated murder ones.
Maybe it would be logical to ask the two of you what, assuming we were desirous of attempting to provide a more extended period of jurisdiction for the board, what offenses do you think, let's pass the constitutional issue for a moment, as a matter of policy, let's assume it's constitutional for a moment, what offenses do you feel it would be appropriate to embrace within that policy? Do you have any comment or recommendation?
That's a very difficult question because you're going to get an answer you're not going to like, and that is, I feel that when you're dealing with people with mental illness, the most dangerous offense is not, the person that commits the most dangerous offense is not necessarily the one that's most dangerous in terms of predicting another crime. For example, the people that commit murder, and I think the corrections division people will tell you that, are often our very best conditional releases, especially when it's somebody that kills somebody in their family or a situation where it's a very situational sort of crime, then do very well in conditional release if they stay on their medication and they're monitored and they get some mental health treatment, are sometimes the safest. And you can get some people that commit this misdemeanors that the board would probably think are more dangerous than the person they saw before them that committed the murder. Now, I think that's different from, at least partially different from what you would hear in the correction system. I don't know if there's any way to really, that's the problem we have. The prediction of dangerousness does not necessarily tie to the first crime. An interesting thing you might do is look at...
Not necessarily tied to what?
To what the initial crime was. You might look at the chart we have of new crimes that were committed, because there Jeffrey Rogers gives you the new charge and as well as the original crime. And a serious original crime does not necessarily relate to a serious second charge. But we haven't really, the only crimes we've looked at is the list that you had in 2075. I haven't thought of any other amendments to that. I mean, we haven't been dealing with that.
Let us remember, we've already decided in law, right or wrong, there are certain crimes which we allow a 20-year sentence, 30-year sentence to be handed down. That is in law, right? I mean, and it was only those crimes. So what I'm saying, I'm not trying to confuse you, those crimes that we're talking about, so I'll make it very simple, the big and bad, the 30-year shot, I realize we even included that, the 20-year shot, but I'm trying to make the 30-year shot, that's a policy decision the legislature has made, it's part of the law, that regardless of what this, those are very serious crimes according to the Oregon legislature and the governor, past, present, future. And people who committed them, that is what we're talking about here. I realize this list, Mr. Chair, doesn't affect Section 3 of the bill. And
I don't know what their statistics will show in terms of those types of individuals.
If I might add one other thing to consider that I personally think is important, that is that I think a lot of people that come under our jurisdiction get the maximum period of time for a crime that they would never get in the correction system. In other words, in the correction system, they would have plea bargained, pleaded to a lesser offense. I really question him whether we are getting a longer period of time because of that in some cases.
Just addressing the policy question, I think we have inadequate information to really say, as an empirical matter, is it true that a person convicted of a person found insane of a dangerous crime is more likely to commit a new crime? I started analyzing that when the bill first came out. We ran off all the specially designated offenders through our computer system, tried to look at what had happened to them, and tried to get some statistical comparison to the non-specially designated offenders. It looked as if there wasn't a major distinction, but in terms of their future dangerousness. But I can't tell you that for sure. However, what Representative Courtney says, I think as a policy matter, makes a lot of sense, and that is, as a policy, the legislature has already said certain kinds of crimes are considered worse, are considered more dangerous, if you will, are considered more heinous, and they are going to be dealt with more severely, whether or not there's a greater likelihood of danger in the future. So if you're going to designate crimes, I think it probably makes most sense to designate the most serious crimes designated elsewhere, designated by the legislature elsewhere. That doesn't necessarily mean you will, in fact, be catching the most dangerous people. But I don't know how to do that, except to, of course, that's what the board tries to do in its day-to-day decisions, is catch the most dangerous people regardless of the crime and deal with them differently. So there's a mechanism for already trying to do that, and that is the board's discretion. But if you're going to overlay some kind of framework and you get by the constitutional issues, which I think are real, then Representative Courtney says makes a lot of sense to me. There's already an existing system. Why not use it?
Representative Courtney, your reference then to the offenses to be included would be those that are embraced within sub 1 of Section 3, murder as defined, 163.115, or any aggravated form thereof?
Yeah.
Or an attempt to commit any such offense?
Yeah.
I'm pretty, Made it work. 27. No, no, no. Dagger.
And 163.1.